You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. And they were given in Dornach, Switzerland between December 23rd, 1921 and January 7th, 1922. Lecture 1, Dornach, 23rd of December, 1921. First of all, I should like to express my great joy at meeting so many of you here in this hall. Anyone whose life is filled with enthusiasm for the movement which is centered here in the Gertianum is bound to experience happiness and a deep inner satisfaction at witnessing the intense interest for our theme which your visit has shown. I should therefore like to begin this introductory lecture by welcoming you all most warmly. And I wish to extend a special welcome to Mrs. Mackenzie, whose initiative and efforts have brought this course about. Footnote: Millicent Mackenzie was professor of education at Cardiff University from 1910 until 1915. End of footnote. On behalf of the anthroposophical movement, I owe her a particular debt of gratitude. I should like to add that it is not just a single person who is greeting you here, but that it is, above all, this building, the Gertianum itself, which is receiving you. I can fully understand if some of you feel critical about certain features of this Gertianum as a building, as a work of art. Any undertaking which makes its appearance in the world in this way must be left open to judgment, and any criticism made in good faith is appreciated, certainly by me. But whatever your reactions may be to this building, the Gertianum itself is, nevertheless, welcoming you. By its forms and artistic composition alone, you can see that here the aim was not to erect a building which was to serve specific purposes, such as education, for example. The underlying spirit and style of this building shows that it was conceived and erected out of the spirit of our times in order to serve a movement destined to play its part in this our present civilization. And as education represents an integral part of human civilization, it is right for it to be nurtured here at this center. The close relationship between anthroposophical activities and educational problems will occupy us in greater detail within the next few days. Today, however, as part of these introductory remarks, I should like to talk about something which really is part and parcel of any established movement. In a way, you have come here in order to acquaint yourselves with the various activities which are centered here in the Gertianum in Dornach. And in greeting you as guests most warmly, I feel it right, first of all, to introduce you to our movement. The aims of this anthroposophical movement, which has been in existence now for some 20 years, are only gradually beginning to manifest themselves. Only lately has this movement been looked upon by the world in general in ways which are consistent with its original aims. But this movement has gone through different phases, and a description of these phases may best serve as a proper introduction. At first, the small circle of its adherents looked upon anthroposophy as a movement representing a religious world outlook in quite a narrow sense. This movement tended to attract people who were not particularly interested in its scientific background and who were not motivated to explore its artistic possibilities. Nor were they aware of how its practical activities could affect the entire social life. These first members were mainly people who felt dissatisfied with traditional religious practice. They were the kind of people who were prompted out of their deepest human longings to search for answers to problems inherent in the human soul and spirit, problems which could not be answered for them by the religious movements then existing. For me, it often was quite astonishing to witness how what I had to say about the fundamentals of anthroposophy was not at all understood by these members, who, nevertheless, supported the movement with deep sympathy and great devotion. When content of a more scientific nature was given, these first members extracted from it what spoke to their hearts, what appealed to their immediate feelings and sentiments. And I can truly say that this time was the most peaceful time within the anthroposophical movement, although this was not at all what I had been looking for. Because of this situation, it was possible for the anthroposophical movement in its first phase to join another movement, albeit only outwardly and mainly from an administrative point of view, which may be known to you as the Theosophical Society. People who, out of the simplicity of their hearts, are searching for knowledge of the eternal within human nature, will find satisfaction equally well in the Theosophical Society as in the anthroposophical movement, unless they are able to discern vital and fundamental differences. The Theosophical Society is mainly concerned with a theoretical form of knowledge, embracing cosmology, philosophy, and religion, and using the spoken or printed word as its medium. People who are really quite satisfied with their lives in general, but who wish to learn more about spiritual matters than traditional doctrines have to offer, may find equal satisfaction in either of the two movements. And only when it became evident, though this was noticed by only a few members, that the aims of anthroposophy regarding cosmology, philosophy, and religion were not merely theoretical, but that these were meant to enter social life quite directly and practically, and in accordance with the demands of the spirit of our times, only then, gradually, did it become obvious for inner reasons that the anthroposophical movement could no longer work together with the Theosophical Society. For in our time, and this will be made clearer in the forthcoming lectures, any movement which confines itself to questions of cosmology, philosophy, and religion in a more or less theoretical way is bound to degenerate into quite an intolerable dogmatism. And it was the futility of dogmatic arguments which finally caused the separation of the anthroposophical movement from the Theosophical Society. It is self-evident that any sensible person conversant with Western culture could not take seriously what became the crux of these dogmatic quarrels at the time when the anthroposophical movement split off from the Theosophical Society. These quarrels were sparked off by the claims that an Indian boy was the reincarnation of Christ. As such a claim was quite baseless. It was totally unacceptable. Footnote: Rudolf Steiner here refers to claims made by Annie Besant and Ledbetter of the reappearance of Christ in the person of the Indian boy Krishnamurti, who later on himself refuted these claims. End of footnote. To waste energy and strength on theoretical arguments is not the way of anthroposophy, which aims at entering life quite directly. When, in accordance with the true aims of anthroposophy, it became essential to work in the artistic, social, scientific, and above all in the educational sphere, the separation from the Theosophical Society became inevitable. Naturally, this did not happen all at once, but fundamentally everything that occurred in the anthroposophical movement after 1912 was a sure sign that this movement had to fight for its independent position in the world in order to penetrate practical life. In 1907, during a congress at the Theosophical Society in Munich, I realized, for the first time, that it was not possible for me to work together with this movement. My friends from the German section of the Theosophical Society and I had been given the task of arranging the program for this congress. Apart from the usual kinds of items, we also included a performance of a mystery play by Edward Charest, entitled The Sacred Drama of Eleusis. In doing so, we decided to create a transition from the theoretical religious attitude of this movement to a wider outlook which would also encourage artistic activities. From our anthroposophical point of view, we had looked upon this performance as an artistic endeavor. However, those personalities within the movement who were trying to satisfy their religious feelings, which at times can be very egoistical, used this occasion for only a theoretical interpretation of the play. Questions were asked such as, what is the meaning of this personality in the drama? What does this other personality signify? These people were only happy when they had succeeded in reducing the whole play to a kind of theoretical terminology. Well, a movement which, because of its one-sided attitude, cannot embrace life in its fullness, is bound to end up as a sectarian movement. Anthroposophy, on the other hand, is not at all inclined toward such sectarianism, because its natural tendency is to bring ideals down to earth and to enter life in practical ways. These attempts at freeing the anthroposophical movement from a sectarian attitude through entering the artistic sphere represent the second phase of its history. Gradually, as the numbers of its members increased, a need was felt for the thought content of philosophy, cosmology, and religion to be expressed artistically, and this prompted me to write my mystery plays. On no account must these be interpreted theoretically or abstractly, for they are intended to be directly experienced on the stage. In order to bring this about, these plays were performed in ordinary hired theaters in Munich from 1910 to 1913. This, in turn, led to the impulse to build a center for the anthroposophical movement. Changing situations made it obvious that Munich was not the right place for such a building, and so we were finally led to the Dornach Hill, where the Goetheanum was built at the right and proper as the right and proper center for the anthroposophical movement. These new activities showed that, in keeping with its true spirit, the anthroposophical movement is ever ready to pervade all branches of human life. Let us imagine that another movement of a more theoretical religious character had decided to build itself a center. What would have happened? First, its members would have collected funds among sympathizers, a step which unfortunately is indispensable, and then they would have chosen an architect to design a building for them, possibly in an antique or Renaissance style, in a Gothic or Baroque or any other traditional style. However, when the anthroposophical movement was in the happy position of being able to build its own home, such a procedure would have been totally unacceptable to me. For anything which forms an organic, living whole cannot possibly be put together out of heterogeneous parts. What relationship could any words spoken out of the spirit of anthroposophy have had with the forms surrounding the listener in a building of Baroque, antique, or Renaissance style? A movement expressing itself in theories is only capable of presenting abstract ideas. A living movement, on the other hand, must work into all branches of life through its own characteristic impulses. Therefore, the urge for expressing life, soul, and spirit in practical deeds, characteristic of anthroposophy, demanded that the surrounding architectural forms, the glowing colors of the wall paintings, the pillars meeting our gaze, that all these forms and colors should speak the same language as that spoken theoretically in ideas, in abstract thoughts. Any previous living movement which existed in the world in bygone times was equally comprehensive. The architecture of antiquity was by no means divorced from the culture of its days, but it grew out of the theoretical and practical activities of the times. The same can be said about the Renaissance, certainly about the Gothic, but also about the Baroque styles. In order to avoid a sectarian or theoretical ideology, anthroposophy had to find its own architectural and artistic style. As mentioned before, one may find this style unsatisfactory or even paradoxical. But the fact is that, in accordance with its true nature, anthroposophy simply had to create its own physical enclosure. Let me make a comparison which may appear trivial, but which nevertheless may clarify these thoughts. Think of a walnut and its kernel. It is obvious that both nut and shell have been created by the same forces, for both together make a whole. Had Anthroposophy been housed in an incongruous building, it would have been as if a walnut kernel had been found in the shell of a different plant. Nature produces nut and shell, and both speak the same language. Likewise, what was needed here was neither symbolism nor allegory, but anthroposophical impulses had to flow directly into artistic creativity. If thoughts are to be expressed in this building, they must have a fitting shell, both from an artistic and architectural point of view. This, however, was no easy task, for the tendency toward sectarianism is strong today, even among people who are looking for a widening of religious ideals. But Anthroposophy must not be influenced by people's sympathies or antipathies. It must remain true to its own principles, which are closely linked to the needs and yearnings of our times, as will be shown in the next few days. And so Anthroposophy entered the practical domain, as far as this was possible in those days. At that time I surprised some members with the following statement, quote, "Anthroposophy wants to enter all walks of life. Although conditions do not permit us to do so today, I should simply love to open banks run on anthroposophical lines." Close quote. This may sound paradoxical, but it was meant to indicate that Anthroposophy is only in its right element if it can fertilize every aspect of life. On no account must it be looked upon merely as a philosophical and religious movement. We now come to the catastrophic and chaotic times of the World War I, which produced their own particular needs. In September 1913, we had laid the foundation stone of this building. In 1914, when the war broke out, we were building the foundations of the Goetheanum. Here I only wish to say that at the time when Europe was torn asunder by opposing nationalistic aspirations, here in Dornach we succeeded in keeping a place open where people from all nations could meet and work together peacefully, united by a common spirit. This was a source of deep inner satisfaction. Those war years could be considered as the second phase in the development of our movement. Despite the efforts made to continue anthroposophical work during the war, the outer activities of the anthroposophical movement were largely paralyzed. But one could experience how, gradually, among peoples everywhere, an inner need was felt for spiritual sustenance, which, in my opinion, could be given through Anthroposophy. When, after 1918, the war had come to an end, at least outwardly, the interest in a spiritual renewal, such as Anthroposophy wished to provide, grew enormously. Between autumn 1918 and spring 1919, a number of friends, many from Stuttgart, came to see me in Dornach. They were deeply concerned about the social conditions of the time, and they wanted the anthroposophical movement to take an active part in trying to deal with the social and economic upheavals. This led to the third phase of our movement. It happened that southern Germany, and Württemberg in particular, was the place which was open to such anthroposophical activities, and one had to work wherever this was possible. These activities, however, were colored a little by the problems of that particular region, problems which were the result of the prevailing social chaos. An indescribable misery had spread over the whole of Middle Europe at that time. Yet seen in a wider context, the suffering from material needs was small compared with what was happening in the soul sphere of the population. One could feel how mankind had to face the most fundamental questions of human existence, questions once raised by Rousseau, which led to outer consequences in the French Revolution, did not touch the most elementary human yearnings and needs to the same extent as the ones which presented themselves in 1919, in the very realms in which we wished to work. Everything connected with the social organism, as it had developed over the past centuries, out of its constituent tribes and peoples, was being questioned. This situation prompted me to address a short proclamation dealing with the threefold social order, to the German people and to the civilized world in general, and also to publish my book titled Toward Social Renewal. Many other activities connected with the social question took place, at first in South Germany, and they were the outcome of this general situation with its prevailing mood. At that time it was essential, though immensely difficult, to touch the most fundamental aspirations of the human soul. Despite their physical and mental agony, people were called upon to search, quite abstractly, for great and sublime truths, but because of the general upheaval, they were incapable of doing so. Many a listener at my addresses said to me afterward, quote, "All of this may be quite right, and even beautiful, but it concerns the future of man. We who have faced death so often during the last years have given up worrying about the future. We have to live from day to day. And why should we show any more interest in the future now than when we had to face the guns every day?" Close quote. Such a typical comment characterizes the apathy prevalent at that time toward the most important and fundamental questions of human development. In this situation, there grew in the hearts of my friends an awareness of a specific need within the body social. It was the realization that, perhaps, the only effective way of working toward a better future lay in our directing our efforts toward the young, toward their education. Our friend Emil Molt, who at that time was in charge of the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory in Stuttgart, offered his services for such an enterprise by founding the Waldorf School for the children of his workers, and I was asked to take a leading part in the running of the school. During pre-war times, one could observe all kinds of educational experiments being carried out in various special schools. But in our case, there was no question of founding yet another country boarding school, nor of implementing a particular brand of educational principles. Our aim was to attempt to heal social ills and to serve the needs of mankind in general. You will learn more about the fundamentals of Waldorf education during the coming lectures. Here I merely wish to point out that, as also in every other field, anthroposophy sees its tasks in involving itself in the realities of a given situation. It was not for us to open a boarding school somewhere in a beautiful stretch of open countryside where we would be free to do as we pleased. We had to fit into definite given conditions. We were asked to teach children of a small town. That is to say, we had to open a school in a small town, where even our highest aspirations had to be founded entirely on pragmatic and sound educational principles. We were not free to choose a particular locality, nor to select our pupils according to ability or class, but we accepted given conditions with the aim of basing our work on spiritual knowledge. In this way, as a natural consequence of anthroposophical striving, Waldorf education came into existence. The Waldorf School in Stuttgart soon ceased to be what it was in the beginning, namely a school for the children of workers employed in the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. It soon attracted pupils from various social backgrounds, and today parents wish to send their children from all over the place. From its initial number of 140 pupils, it has now grown to over 600 pupils, and applications for further places are coming in all the time. A few days ago, we had to lay the foundation stone for a highly necessary extension to our school buildings, and we hope that despite all the difficulties which one has to face when engaged in this kind of work, we shall be able to expand our school further in the near future. However, I wish to emphasize that the characteristic feature of this school lies in its educational principles, based on the knowledge of man, and in its ability to adapt these to outer given realities. If one is able to choose pupils according to ability or social standing, or if one can choose one's locality, it is comparatively easy to carry out imaginary or perhaps even real educational reforms. But to found and develop a school on educational principles which are closely connected with the most fundamental human impulses, while at the same time keeping in close touch with the demands of practical life, is no easy task. In this way, during its third phase, our anthroposophical movement has spread into the social sphere, and this aspect will naturally occupy us in greater depth during the coming days. But you must realize that what has been happening in the Waldorf School up till now represents only a beginning of the endeavors to bring our fundamental aims right down into the practicalities of life. Concerning other anthroposophical activities which have been developed later on, I should like to mention that a large number of scientifically trained people came together because they hoped and believed that the anthroposophical movement also could fertilize the scientific branches of life. Medical men met here because they were dissatisfied with the ways of natural science, which only accept outer observation and experimentation. They were convinced that such a limited attitude could never lead to a full understanding of the human organism, both in its healthy and ill conditions. Doctors came who were deeply concerned about the unnecessary limitations set by modern medical science, such as the deep chasm dividing medical practice into pathology and therapy. These two branches coexist today almost as if they were separate sciences. In its search for knowledge, anthroposophy not only uses methods of outer experimentation, that is, the observation of outer phenomena synthesized by the intellect, but, looking upon man as a being of body, soul, and spirit, it employs also other means, which I shall characterize in the coming days. Instead of dealing with abstract thought content, it is in touch with the living spirit. And because of this, anthroposophy was able to meet the aspirations of persons who were urgently seeking to bring new life into medicine. As a consequence of this, I was asked to give two courses here in Dornach to university-trained specialists in medicine and to practicing doctors in order to outline the contribution anthroposophy could make in the field of pathology and therapy. Both here in Dornach and nearby in Arlesheim, as also in Stuttgart, medical therapeutic institutions have sprung up, which are working with their own medicaments and which are trying to utilize what anthroposophy can offer toward healing, toward dealing with sickness and health. Specialists in other sciences have also come to look for new impulses arising out of anthroposophy, and so courses were given in physics and astronomy. In this way, anthroposophical spirit knowledge was called upon to bring practical help to the various branches of scientific endeavor. A characteristic feature of this third phase of the anthroposophical movement lies in the fact that gradually, despite a certain amount of remaining opposition, people have come to recognize that spiritual science, as practiced here, can meet every demand for an exact scientific basis of working, and that anthroposophy, as represented here, can work with equal discipline and in harmony with any other scientific enterprise. In time, people will appreciate more and more what has been the potential of the anthroposophical movement all along during these last 20 years. Another example, showing how the most varied fields of human striving can be fructified through anthroposophy, is the creation of a new art of movement, which we call eurythmy. This art uses the human being as its means of expression, as its instrument, and in this way it aims at achieving its specific results. And so we try to let anthroposophical life, but not anthroposophical theories, flow into all kinds of other activities, such as the art of recitation and declamation, of which more details will be given in the next few days. This last phase, with its educational, medical, and artistic impulses, is the most characteristic one of the anthroposophical movement. Anthroposophy has many supporters as well as many enemies, even bitter enemies, but it has now entered upon the very stage of activities for which it has been waiting. And so it was a satisfying experience during my stay in Christiania, footnote now known as Oslo, from 23rd November to 4th December this year, to speak about anthroposophical life to educators and government economists, as well as to Norwegian students and to various other circles. All of these were willing to accept not theories or religious sectarian ideas, but what is waiting to reveal itself directly out of the spirit of our times in answer to the great needs of humanity. So, much about the three phases of the anthroposophical movement. As an introduction to our course, I merely wished to acquaint you with this movement, to mention its name to you, as it were. Tomorrow, then, we shall begin with our actual theme. However, I want you to know that it is this anthroposophical movement, with its deep educational interests, which is happy to welcome you all here in the Goetheanum. The end of Lecture 1.